Hello and welcome to the NDA podcast. My name's Justin Pierce and I'm the editor. Today's podcast is one in our NDA Meets series where we talk to some of the industry's most interesting and influential people. And today I'm really excited because this person's just been one of my industry heroes for a long time. It's Terry Khawaja. He's the founder and CEO of Luma Partners, a strategic advisory firm. Terry's one of the most well-known people in this industry, so needs no real introduction. But simply put, he is one of the most influential people in ad tech, and he's been responsible for over 300 billion of transactions in the space. He knows everyone. He knows everything. I can't wait to find out what he thinks. So, Terry, great to see you.
Likewise, Justin.
Can we start off with a question? You described our industry as being in the midst of a perfect storm last year. Are we still in the midst of a perfect storm?
Well, the perfect storm I was referencing was the culmination of two major positive effects. One was the tailwinds of our industry sector, which is a long-running theme of sort of the conversion of media and marketing from art to science. And it really centers on the five attributes of our sector that are pretty much unique if you look across all industries. And that is size, $1 trillion, growth, 20% a year for 25 years, fragmentation, thousands of companies, complexity, a lot of moving parts between media, services, data, and software. And finally, dynamics. If you don't like anything in this industry, just wait 6 months, it'll be completely different. So the combination of those five things create a positive sort of industry tailwind that's pretty strong. Last year, or a little over a year ago, year and a half ago, we also had incredible positive market environments. We had strong valuations. We had open markets for IPOs. We had a tremendous amount of M&A activity, great valuations. So the perfect storm I was referencing is now dated. We only have one of those. Fortunately, we still have the one with the longest legs, the sectoral tailwinds that will likely continue for quite some period of time. We did, however, lose the market one. We have all these now macro uncertainties with inflation and war and all kinds of other things. Some of those have abated. Some of those have proven to be not as negative as feared. Take, for example, inflation or the, you know, pending recession question, you know, are we going to have a soft landing? I think that's not settled and we still have a war in Europe, but it feels better today than it did before. The market has come back. Deals have in Q2 of 2023 hit an 11-year low in terms of deal activity. We are of the view that that will turn out to be a nadir, not just a low. And we're already seeing dialogue pick up and activity resume to more normal levels in the second half and then into 2024. So not quite the perfect. We lost an arm of the perfect storm, but I believe some of that is going to come back.
So you mentioned lots of macro factors such as the economy, and that's not going away. But then do you think those factors, what's the biggest challenge to our industry? The macroeconomic, the economy, which can't really be influenced by the industry, obviously, or factors such as privacy and the disappearance of the cookie, the intra-industry issues. Which is more challenging, do you think?
You know, it's hard to gauge as to which one's more. I would say you're correct in noting that the macro is largely exogenous, right? We can't control that. That's up to, you know, central bankers and a variety of other market factors that we don't control. I would say that the challenges we've seen on signal deprecation are coming both from legislation, but also, you know, corporations are retracting their signals, witness Apple. That is having a significant impact on the industry. But this is an industry that has been called for dead now many times for many reasons. First, it was the walled gardens. Then it was privacy. AI, you name it. Everybody's got a rationale to say why advertising on the open web is going to be dead, and it never is. So I'm an optimist. I think this is a sector that's very, very important. It's the monetization engine of the open internet, and therefore journalism and all kinds of all other good stuff associated with that. But also, it has demonstrated a resiliency that's almost, unrivaled. I mean, we keep throwing existential challenges in the way of this industry, and we somehow manage to, innovate our way to, or iterate or innovate our way to a continuing outcome.
No, I totally agree. I think sometimes ad tech gets a bad name, but ad tech is just technology that supports advertising. It's not going anywhere. Technology is not going anywhere. But we do have, so you mentioned this, all the deal numbers were down, and we do have some, pretty horrendous things happening in the market, such as MediaMath disappearing. Now, what do you think the, because someone like MediaMath disappears and a lot of money is owed across the ecosystem. So what sort of impact does that sort of collapse have?
Well, I mean, first of all, let's call it what it is. It's a tragedy, right? And I feel bad for the employees, the counterparties. There's a lot of it's not a great situation. That having been said, I reject this narrative that it's somehow a contagion or evidence of other demise. No, it's simply this. MediaMath made the same mistake that Seismic made and Videology made, which is they debt-financed growth, and then the growth didn't materialize. So there were a variety of reasons as to why the growth didn't materialize. There was some strategic mistakes. There was outmaneuvering by competitors. Nonetheless, that happens every single day in startup land. The difference with those few companies is they debt finance growth. And the way debt works is, we'll lend you money, but we want our money back. And therefore, we put in covenants such that if you trip said covenants, we will put you in bankruptcy and then end the company in order to preserve them getting a return on their capital. No blame for them. That's the nature of that type of capital. And it's just the company made the mistake of utilizing that kind of financing in order to minimize equity dilution. But obviously, it ultimately resulted in 100% equity dilution.
And how significant impact do you think this sort of collapse can have? Because as I say, money's owed everywhere. Everyone's made money out of this. And especially we're seeing terms get longer.
A bump in the road. I mean, it is lots of money, but it's not existential amounts of money. And I think some counterparties had been wary of MediaMath that this was a potential outcome and had been, limiting their exposure over time. So I don't think it has any sort of structural impact on the industry.
So let's talk about the Lumiscape. The Lumiscape, which kind of you're most famous for, among many other things. Lumiscape's more than 15 years old now. I've always loved them. They keep evolving. So the question is really to you, do you think we'll always need Lumiscape? I.e., is this industry ever going to get to a stage where it's simplicity itself and doesn't need another Lumiscape for another sector?
God, I hope not. So one of my five attributes of this sector that I referenced, number three, is fragmentation. So normally, when you look at the development of a particular industry sector, you can parse it into three phases: a new company formation, maturity, and then rationalization and consolidation. And usually, in an industry sector, you can map the number of competitors at its apex, at the top of the arc, if you will, in the number of companies in dozens or maybe hundreds. In ad tech and martech, the number of companies is denoted in thousands. So you've got this explosive proliferation. I could go into reasons as to why. It's the availability of venture capital, coupled with the fact that you can launch a company with virtually no capital, because we are dealing with an existing flow of advertising spend. But the point is, we have so many companies we crossed the Rubicon, if you will, in 2015, early 2016, which is to say we are past the apex and we are now in the rationalization and consolidation phase of our industry. Finally, I've been calling for it for years. We're now officially there, and I denote that by the number of acquisitions from companies in the Lumascapes relative to new entrants on the Lumascapes. So the consolidating names have finally outnumbered the new names. But don't get me wrong, there's always innovation, there's always fresh blood, there's what we call green shoot areas of interest that people are pursuing, whether that be commerce, media, AI, CTV, et cetera. But we are in a net consolidation phase. And until such time as we get this industry to what almost every other industry looks like, which is like, you know, handful of players, which ultimately that ought to be the goal, not necessarily a handful, but the goal ought to be like to go like every other industry, which is fewer players with higher volumes at lower take rates. If you look at the margins of these ad tech companies and, you know, the whole, you know, derogatory reference of the ad tech tax, it's a reference to how much they pull out of what's called working media, or ultimately the dollars that end up going to publishers. Well, I think that's a transitory or a temporary phenomena. And ultimately, when we get fewer players at much higher take rates, they can afford to have, much higher volumes. They can afford to have lower take rates. And witness, for example, television, where, you know, take rates of that mature media sector are, you know, 1%.
Okay, you mentioned television, and I was at the Possible Conference in Miami. I know you were too, when Linda Yaccarino did her kind of onstage job interview with Elon Musk. You're a big supporter of Linda. You make sort of videos sing her praises, etc. What do you think that she's going to be able to rescue Twitter's reputation in the eyes of advertisers? I saw you yesterday, or maybe early this morning, on Twitter having a bit of a negative view on what's going on Twitter, which is kind of unlike your thing on social media. So yeah, is she able to rescue Twitter's reputation in the eyes of advertisers?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I love Twitter, and I'm a big fan of Linda Yaccarino. So I want it to work. I want it to improve. I have great respect for Elon Musk. He's obviously phenomenal entrepreneur. Has done amazing things with amongst tackling humanity's most challenging issues, not just trying to slightly marginally improve, you know, social media. And so I have great respect. That having been said, I think he, A, doesn't understand media. You know, this whole venture and exercise into buying Twitter or not, and then yes, and then this is just a manifestation of his id. And it's kind of bizarre to see play out. And I know he thinks it doesn't matter and he's just goofing around. And ultimately, I believe he does want free speech. He has probably altruistic ideas in his head. It's just that how he goes about it is chaos and carnage. And, you know, that will have to be, this will be Linda's greatest challenge. She's a consummate professional and a passionate person who, you know, look, there's a lot to like about the Twitter product and where it could go. I also believe Twitter stagnated. So I like the fresh approach of trying to figure out what can be done with this unique audience and this sort of town hall conversation opportunity. So I like the innovative ideas. It's just that he just can't help himself. He's loading a gun and shooting it at his own feet or neck or what have you. And my mantra is just let her do her job. He made the right choice by bringing in Linda. Let her do her job.
When you say Twitter stagnated, in what way do you mean exactly?
Well, I just think their ad business kind of languished. You know, I think Twitter could be so much more. I have ideas on what Twitter can be. And I have talked to Twitter board members over the years about that. And Linda and I had lunch a few weeks back, and I briefed her on these ideas, and I wrote up a summary. So I'm hopeful that they'll recognize the comparative advantage of the unique attributes that Twitter has, coupled with some of the dynamics in the sector that have proven that almost no publishers, or sorry, no platforms are truly friends of publishers. And I think Twitter has a unique opportunity there. So hopefully we'll have a chance to implement some of those strategies.
Fingers crossed. So look, we started off and you're talking about the various macroeconomic and intra-industry issues that are facing everyone, especially advertisers. So what's the future, do you think, for companies, ad tech companies, that are built on the back of cookie targeting?
So cookie's a proxy, right? And it's an accidental proxy. It's a proxy for third-party identity so that you can do some form of targeting based on past behaviors. Turns out that's not the only way to target. So let me back up and answer the question first and then give you the detail. I think we're going to be fine. And the reason I say that is the level of sophistication of other forms of targeted advertising around context, around cohorts, basically some of which are alternatives to third-party targeting, like first-party data with constructs like data clean rooms in order to get them to scale. But ultimately, first-party data won't get there, right? It's at best 10 or maybe 15% of your addressable audience. So we will need audience extension capabilities, and I believe we're entering a new world of sort of probabilistic data. And I say probabilistic because you are essentially taking educated guesses with some signals that don't necessarily involve identity. So I think there are three ways this is going to perpetuate. One is by using first-party data with constructs to be able to make them broader. Add to that the probabilistic models that will help you get to scale on audience targeting. And then the third is alternatives, so the contextual type alternatives. And I'm encouraged because the early experiments by Google of their cohort-based targeting have demonstrated that it's got real efficacy. Perhaps not 100%, but if you get it to 75% and at scale, that'll work just fine. So I do think companies that are perceived to have a reliance on the cookie, and some of that perception is overdone. So like LiveRamp or Criteo, for example, I think it's those companies are oversold as it relates to what will happen come December 31, 2023, or probably more aptly when we get to zero cookies in September of 2024, I think there will be a continuation of the ability to do targeted audience-based media buying.
With so much focus on identity and everyone's struggling to find the solution for post-cookie, why has there been so little M&A activity, deal-making going on in the identity space itself, do you think?
Well, I might do a little pushback on that premise. We've sold quite a number of companies in that realm, but you know, TrueOptic and now I'm blanking on all the names, but we've done a half a dozen trades in and around it. But I think what you're referencing is identity per se, like specific identity. And I think the reason for that paucity of deal making is there is no silver bullet. There is no solution where we go, okay, so the answer to cookies is X. There is no one X. And it's hard to have a currency if you don't have a dominant ID. There's probably, last time I checked, there was over 80 different IDs competing in the marketplace. Some of which I think will fall prey to the sort of insatiability of privacy zealots who will come after all kinds of different forms of identity. Even hell, in Europe, they're coming after first party data because their claim is there has to be use case consent. You can't have blanket consent. You have to have consent on every single interaction. And by the way, that just, you know, I could go down a road here cause for an hour long podcast in and of itself. I am of the view that we as an industry have totally messed up this privacy thing. I think the privacy advocacy is being made by zealots on behalf of consumers who don't give a shit. Sorry if I'm not allowed to say that.
You can swear as much as you want.
Who don't care. I mean, I'm not saying they don't care about privacy infractions. I mean, obviously there are certain forms of privacy infractions that all humans should be protected from and have a right against. I'm talking about anonymous sort of general interest to do some targeted advertising. I simply do not believe that there is a broad-based uproar against this. And yet these zealots have done a great job of running circles around the industry and getting all this legislation. And how do I know this? Because we have an experiment of 530 million people. It's called the EU, that every single day when they open a web page, they have to click whether they consent to cookies. And it's 99.8% yes. So it's an annoyance. It has harmed the UX of every user, especially in the EU. Sorry for that. Well, I guess you're in the UK, so that might be a little different. But the point is, it's made it worse. There's been no benefit, and the industry has so poorly handled this issue.
So is there a solution, and who's going to drive this? Is it trade bodies? Is it advertisers? Is it you, Terry? Is there a solution for this?
Not going to be me. Let's see. Yeah, I think we'll probably get there with probabilistic models, which is to say constructs to be able to expand sort of first-party data. So first-party data we'll utilize as the kernel. And then we'll do what used to be called lookalike modeling, but it's far more sophisticated these days, where we can get substantially the benefits of audience-based targeted advertising without necessarily having to have the actual data on all of those people. Because I think we lost the game on data and privacy as it relates to third-party signals.
Okay, I want to talk about various different areas of the industry, but first, what I'm interested to know is from you. I mean, you're so instrumental in this industry, and you put so many deals together globally. So, what's your view of the difference between UK, where I'm sitting now, so entrepreneurs in ad tech, and US entrepreneurs? What's the difference in the individuals, the people behind sort of our great companies?
Oh, I think there's some great UK entrepreneurs. I've sold several UK companies. And I'm currently working on some UK businesses. I think the broader sort of difference when you step back is, and I think this is one of the greatest attributes of American entrepreneurs, is their belief that they're infallible. They just go for it, right? And by the way, failing at, look, I'm Canadian. I grew up in Canada, which is kind of like halfway between the UK and the US. Failure in Canada when I was growing up was just, that's the death knell, right? It was like you would avoid that at all costs. So you end up with a population and a generation of risk-averse people. And I could see it in people's choices as to careers. And, you know, they were accountants or lawyers. They hated their job. But you know what? It was a steady income. So they didn't want to disappoint their parents. You know, who knows what the motivation was, but it did breed a people that were afraid of losing, afraid of failure. America is very, very different. I moved here and I was like, whoa, it's palpable. Here, people wear failure as a badge of honor. It's like, yeah, tried that. That sucked. Or, you know, flushed 30 million of venture capital. It's called venture capital, right? Most of these firms don't work. And it's not a scarlet letter to try and fail in America in technology entrepreneurism. That is a different, that feels different in Canada. Canada's changing now. I've been gone for 30 years and I stay in touch. And, you know, Canada has now sort of, you know, leaned in a little bit, not quite anywhere near the US, but leaned into this notion of, you know, tech entrepreneurism and failure's okay. And the UK, I would say, is behind Canada in the sense that, you know, the mores, the culture of UK folks is simply not that. So I think that's the cultural is probably the biggest delta. And then, you know, there is some harsh realities, which is companies in Europe and even more so in Asia will invariably, should their buyer end up being local, just the upside is not as great. The multiples are not as high for companies based in Europe. And why is that? It's the size of the addressable market. This probably gets back to culture as well. But exits are not as robust. We're trying to change that one European exit at a time.
Excellent. That's good to hear. So let's sort of rattle through some different areas. Sustainability. Everyone I talk to in the UK market is obsessed by sustainability. It's high on the agenda of CMOs. So what opportunity do you think there is when it comes to sustainability in ad tech?
So I like to depoliticize sustainability. You know, people, you know, it tends to get associated with this, you know, green movement and environment. I'm like, you know what? Do it. It's do it whether you want to save the planet or whether you want to make more profits. Either way, they're both green. That's my line. And so if we depoliticize it and just objectively look at the facts, we have a real-time ecosystem where billions, if not trillions, of ad calls a day are made against the open web in programmatic advertising. And the vast majority of those are a waste. They're unnecessary. So, and every time you do an ad call, there's some CPU utilization, there's storage, there's cloud computing. There's just a lot of cost and energy involved in something that it turns out is wasteful. So I view this as kind of like a no-brainer. Like, if we have a supply chain that was constructed in a manner that turned out to be enormously wasteful, and some simple measures could A, save us a bundle of money, and B, reduce, you know, energy utilization, then who's against that? Like, I think the passion and the fervor and the embracement of sustainability has been for the altruistic save the environment reasons. And I think that's great. Whatever the motivation, I don't care. It's a no-brainer thing to pursue. But my take is do it regardless of your motivations. But let's do it 100%.
Great advice. Okay, there's some other areas. All these areas are hugely, hugely hyped for over the month. But what are the opportunities and are they too overhyped potentially? CTV to start with. And CTV, I'm talking maybe with a more of a European lens than global, especially US, because the markets are so different in many ways. But CTV generally, opportunity, overhyped?
Yeah. So part of my job, I believe, is to parse trends. And I'm often disappointed by people in my position, not necessarily bankers, but people who opine on trends. Because in marketing loves the shiny new object, and they tend to just jump on the bandwagon. You know, whatever the new thing is great. And I think that's irresponsible. I think we need to exercise discretion and really take a hard look at these trends to parse which ones are real and which ones are bullshit. And, you know, so which is why, like in 2016, when everyone came out and said, "Ooh, blockchain is going to solve for fraud." No, it isn't. And I came out at a conference, and my conference in 2016 in front of 500 CEOs said, "No, it isn't. I call it bullshit. It's nonsense. It's two, if not three orders of magnitude off in terms of latency and cost And by the way, it's a solution looking for a problem. It actually doesn't solve it. I know there are still some people that still believe. So whether it's that or 5G, remember, 5G was going to fundamentally change the world. Really? Faster mobile speeds? I call bullshit on that. And then, of course, the big daddy, crypto, Web3, you know, metaverse. I was like, God, this is just horseshit piled on top of horseshit. None of this makes any sense whatsoever. And shame on you, people rely on to parse trends, to just go along with the trend. It gives you something to talk about. Well, it gave me something to talk about, and I came out ardently against it. And by the way, that doesn't help me, right? That's people say, oh, I'm not doing business with you, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, they attack me on Twitter. And by the way, when they attack me ad hominem, which I could care less about, that doesn't bother me. I know I'm right, because they can't address my substance. They have to go at me personally. I'm like, okay, well, I was talking substance. I'm not calling you names, but I said, good to know, kind of thing. At any rate, so there's a, I think it's really important to call balls and strikes. That's an American analogy. Whatever the good shots and bad shots in cricket are, we'll use that instead. So here's ones that I think are real. CTV, absolutely real. And how I know that is it's a consumer-driven trend. So 5G, no consumer said, I need 5G. They didn't know what the hell it was. No one pined for the metaverse. No one at any scale was saying, I need tokens or wallets to do crypto trading. No, consumers weren't driving those trends. Consumers are shifting, obviously, from linear TV and bundled TV, whether it be the UK and European versions or the US versions, to streaming and to digital. And you can see it in the numbers with YouTube viewing and the rise of all these streaming and OTT channels. And if you think about it, and I think that is a long-term trend. I mean, linear is going to take a lot longer to die than people think, just because it always does. And there's a segment of the population still, about 22% in the U.S., that doesn't have broadband. So there's still getting broadcast, and they'll still pay for cable. So linear still has a long tail left to it, but it's inevitable that we're, you know, shifting to these other channels. And the implications for advertising are actually pretty significant, in the sense that TV is one of the rare media channels that is supply constrained, which is to say demand exceeds supply. And as we move from a, you know, cable or satellite delivered linear feed, which tends to have, or at least here in the US, 16 to 18 minutes an hour of adverts. And we're moving to a, you know, under 5 minute of adverts in streaming. That supply constraint is going to be exacerbated. So that's good for pricing, you know, bad for total volume. And it fundamentally changes the economics of the industry. Here in the US, we have something called transfer payments that the broadcasters, you know, get, and the cable companies get, and that's all going away. Retransmission consent. There are some versions of that in Europe that I'm familiar with, but the economics fundamentally change for TV companies. Again, driven by consumers, we will have a wave of challenges. Right, the growth is there, but we're going to have allegations of fraud and a bunch of other things that we'll have to sort out. Because remember, television is 80 years. You know, we've been doing that for 80 years. We're still in the early days of CTV. We'll take a few years to get it sorted out, but it's inevitable that CTV is the future.
Another big hyped area: retail or commerce media. What are your views on that sector?
Another one that's inevitably and positive, and because, you know, a variety of reasons. In fact, if you pull back the lens from just retailers and talk about largely any company with a large consumer network, whether it be a food delivery company or a transportation company, you know, witness, you know, Uber, all of these companies that have a large consumer base are realizing that they can build a media business or an ad business on top of their existing market, Walmart. And it turns out that the margins of media are much higher than their business, whether they're selling televisions like Vizio, or they're selling products like Amazon or Walmart, or they're delivering food like Uber. The bottom line is, you know, these are highly profitable businesses that also help drive drive conversion to your core business. So they're kind of no-brainers for everyone to get into. We came up with a phrase the other day. Eric Seufert's known for this phrase of, you know, everybody's an ad network, or everything's an ad network. And we came up with, you know, ad tech is eating the world. Either way, the point is this is actually a growth area. For retailers specifically, they have razor-thin margins. So not only is this a good business adjunct, it also helps convert to their core business. It helps with conversion. So it's a total no-brainer for them to get into. The bigger ones can do it themselves and own their own tech, but most of the players will utilize, you know, platforms, so they really don't actually have to get that involved with the actual tech deployment. There's lots of vendors out there that can help them. And if you think about it, this ought replace this could usurp, I don't know, 20, 25, 30% of the open internet, which is to say better targeted towards conversion of goods. After all, let's step back and remember that the objective of an advert is to get you to buy something, right? So commerce media seems like a no-brainer. Commerce is advertising perfected. So it's kind of like, makes a lot of sense.
Excellent. Now, you've been, as always, incredibly positive throughout this whole chat, innovations driving growth, etc. So what's the future for ad tech IPOs?
Ad tech IPOs? Well, so ad tech IPOs, let's parse it into, there's right now 47 or 48 public companies in ad tech, not counting the big giants Snap and Facebook or Meta and Google, et cetera. That number will continue to be robust. And remember, 4 years ago, that number was like 8. So we had a lot of IPOs in 2020 and 2021. Those companies, if you look at our most recent Q2 market report, we benchmark the performance of those companies. They're growing nicely. And they're substantially profitable. So it's not like we had a rush of companies that shouldn't have made it. Yes, there's a few stragglers that have dropped in market cap, but the vast majority of them, I believe the number we showed was like 88 or 90% of them beat their numbers in Q2. So it's a healthy cohort, and we'll inevitably see more public companies. By the way, it depends on there being an IPO market. Right now, there's no IPO market. There's speculation that it may be coming back now, and I hope so. But right now, there's kind of no market for IPOs. Stock market's back, so it should follow by logic. And yeah, I think we'll continue to see an IPO as a viable, it's not really an exit, but it's a viable liquidity strategy for companies, scaled companies in ad tech. You know, the nice thing about being in this third phase, this sort of rationalization and consolidation phase of the sector, is that, you know, we've got sizably scaled, profitable companies that either could go public or have attracted the likes of the big private equity firms. I mean, 5 years ago, there was a handful of private equity firms that were spending the time to understand this sector and actively invest. That number is now 24, and they've had some of the most incredible performance. So DoubleVerify was Providence Equity's best returning investment. Same thing with AppLovin for KKR at time of IPO. So there's some great wins out there. It's a classic case of measure twice, cut once, which is to say you really have to pick your targets well, but done right, there's plenty of returns.
I wanted to end this chat talking about events. We always talk about events on this podcast. And events are kind of the lifeblood of the industry, I think, for the last 20 years I've been part of it. You were an investor in Possible, as I mentioned. You're our Cannes parody videos. I love them. They're my favourite every year. So why are events so important, and what's the future for them in this industry, do you think?
Yeah, so the first question, why are they so important? Because throw away the data and the tech and the software and everything, and ultimately it comes down to people. And you have to build personal relationships. I mean, there's some amount of learning that takes place. There's that, but really it's pressing the flesh, getting to, you know, FaceTime with fellow humans. Because it turns out we're not algorithms, right? We're living beings, and it's irreplaceable to build trust, to be able to meet people one-on-one or in groups. But that has to be in real life. I was never a fan of these hybrid, you know, events. They're kind of not interesting for the people not in the room. So the key thing is getting in the room. Now, we have an industry with probably too many events. I don't go to the vast majority of them. I probably go to a low single digit percentage of them, but there are these tentpole events. You mentioned Cannes. Cannes, I think, is a fantastic event. People will say, is that an incredible aggregation of senior people who are in an attitude to deal? Or is it this outrageous party fest boondoggle that's a huge usurper of marketing budgets? And the answer is yes to all of the above. And by the way, you wouldn't have the former if you didn't have the you wouldn't have the latter if you didn't have the former. Being in person is critical, and yet a lot of events are echo chambers, which is to say, you've got events where marketers talk to marketers, events where agency people talk to agency people, and tech talk to tech. And that's all, I suppose, good. There's plenty of use cases for that. But one of the reasons why I am an investor and promoter of and participant in Possible is the it's meant to take a new approach to this world where you have all the constituents in the room. Let's get the marketers, the people actually spending the money, and the agency folks, and the tech intermediaries, and the publishers. Let's get everyone in a room, because I don't know how you make any progress discussing or resolving any kind of industry issues if you don't have the perspectives of all the most important constituent parts. And so with combination of everyone there plus a fresh approach, I think is the winning formula to why I think Possible will be one of the key tentpole events for this sector.
Fantastic. And again, totally agree. So last question, this is, I don't know if it's sort of fair to ask it, but if you would give advice to an entrepreneur or someone just starting off in this industry, what sector would you advise them to go into? Retail media, digital at home?
Oh, yeah, we didn't mention digital at home. The reason why I love at home, I gave a talk to a group of at home people in Cannes, and I said, you know what? For all the, you know, touted benefits of digital and the virality of social and data and all this stuff, I said, here we are, the creme de la creme of this industry all gathers, and what is the primary ad utilization to message to them? Out of home. So out of home works. It just freaking works. In fact, it's probably the one channel of traditional media advertising format that hasn't changed. And in fact, only gets better. So print got deprecated to digital, and TV's losing, you know, audience and eyeballs to CTV, et cetera. But out of home, I'm sorry, physical locations, regulations making it harder for more ads, inventory to go up. So the scarcity factor's going up. It works if you've got really, really good creative. And of course, there's the digital aspect that can bring all kinds of interesting, you know, factors to it. So I have a love for out of home, and I'm excited about a lot of the innovation around digital out of home. But I think your question was broader than that. There's any number of areas. I do recommend going into an area that I describe as green shoot. So don't just get into display advertising. Like, it's like, whatever. I mean, you know, that's that's susceptible to change. And with all the disruption, I think, you know, people have to innovate or die, so to speak. But yeah, there's any number of green shoot areas that I think are fascinating. You know, pick a hard one. Don't pick an easy one. An easy one, you know, that just means less moats. So one with more complexity invariably will mean that it'll be easier to defend once you get to scale. But there are, you know, the nice thing about it, as depicted on the Lumascapes, is this huge fragmentation and a number of companies. I suppose choice makes it harder. It's like a, it's like going to a Greek diner and there's this everything you can choose, you know, any one of 500 things, and it makes it harder. But there are all kinds of areas for personal growth. I think if you're just starting out, it almost doesn't matter. I mean, obviously you would prefer to have a good boss at a good company in a good sector. But if I had to choose amongst those three, I'd pick the good boss, because you'll learn a lot more working for someone who knows what they're doing, regardless of how well the company or the subsector do.
Amazing advice and an amazing way on which to run. Hey, thank you so much. It's been an absolute joy talking to you today.
Great to be with you, Justin.
And thank you so much for listening.